Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
That housing recovery? Not so much.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the Morning Open. The Fed looks closely at where the economy is, and a lot of those jackets you see on the trading floor come from one place. First, where's Wall Street? Numbers are mixed right now. The S&P and NASDAQ both up very slightly. The Dow off now about 8 points, 8.5 points at 10,633. European shares right now are higher right now, under about 0.5%, and markets close mixed today in Asia. The Commerce Department this morning says housing construction fell in February nearly 6%. Now, this report partly blames some of those snowstorms that iced over much of the northeast and southern United States last month. Julie Neiman is analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us live this morning from St. Louis. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Steve.
So was February that stormy? I mean, how much can weather really affect all these economic indicators? I mean, should we really be worried?
Oh, this is like blaming flu for bad retail sales. You know, it's a real stretch here. Yes, we are historically low inventories of new homes, but we're looking at a continued depressed housing market. Builder sentiment is still declining. Buyer traffic down to where we were last year. Where are you building? Well, in the Northeast and the West, but every place else is down. You still see creditors not extending loans to new projects, huge number of distressed properties for sales, and buyers don't want to set into buying right now simply because job prospects are bad.
The Federal Reserve, Julie, is meeting today looking at monetary policy and interest rates. I mean, how does the Fed factor in the info that we got today, these housing starts, to determine whether or when to ease up on these emergency measures?
Well, they're looking at any improving data, and we are seeing some improving data in manufacturing and exports, but the big factor always still jobs, and the hires are still not exceeding the fires here. And inflation, that's the other key thing. We're looking at deflation due to asset prices declining, wages declining, and very high productivity. And moreover, the Fed's looking at credit once again freezing up here. The 9 biggest TARP babies cut back lending again. Mm-hmm. So the Fed's going to jawbone inflation and be cautious language, but they're not going to raise rates for the foreseeable future.
Julie Neiman in St. Louis. Julie, thanks.
You bet.
There's a lot of criticism being pointed at accounting giant Ernst & Young. That's after last week's report on the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And as Sarah Gardner reports, that criticism is tarnishing the industry's image.
Ernst & Young signed off on Lehman's financial statements despite the bank's use of what the examiner called accounting gimmicks that effectively hid billions in debt. Stephen Thomas, an attorney suing Ernst & Young in a separate case, says the big accounting firms are ineffectual watchdogs.
If you go all the way back to Enron, you see that in almost every instance in where we have numbers on Wall Street causing great harm, there was a certified public accountant who reviewed the numbers and gave them their stamp of approval.
But Randy Beatty, dean of USC's accounting school, believes Ernst & Young followed the law. He says Lehman's risky financial deals, not its auditors, caused its collapse.
To my mind, the auditors are simply the folks on the sideline that are trying to provide a snapshot of what's going on in the corporation.
Yesterday, though, Britain's top accounting regulator said he's now investigating Ernst & Young's Lehman audits there. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report for Tuesday, March 16, 2010, at marketplace.org. Tomorrow, the oil cartel OPEC will decide how much oil its members can pump over the next 6 months. Because the global recession slowed energy use, OPEC slashed production at the end of 2008. But despite some push and pull between oil-rich countries, few expect more crude to be produced anytime soon. From London, Christopher Worth has more.
A growing divide is opening up within OPEC over whether to boost production as the global economy tries to get back on track. Poorer members like Angola, Nigeria, and Venezuela want to close their big national budget deficits by expanding oil production. Nick McGregor is with stockbrokers Redmayne Bentley. He says balancing supply and demand isn't easy.
OPEC has learned a fairly brutal lesson in the last couple of years that they do have to balance price or they will kill off the goose that laid the golden egg. And so others, such as the Saudis, take a more balanced view that they'd rather see oil prices as high as they can possibly be, but only if it doesn't actually start to crimp demand in America and Europe and so on.
And with oil prices hovering near $80 a barrel, some OPEC members, like the Saudis, are happy for production levels to stay where they are. McGregor says we shouldn't expect any sea change in prices at the pumps until we get further economic growth, or alternately, signs that the economy might be headed into a double-dip recession. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Also in London, British Airways is preparing for a major strike by flight attendants. Many critical flights between the United States and the UK could be cancelled. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
6,000 flight attendants are expected to walk off the job in protest over pay and staffing levels. The first three-day phase of the strike starts this Saturday. BA is one of the largest transatlantic carriers, and this could have a big impact on lucrative routes to New York. Half of all flights to JFK are likely to be scrapped. The union involved is under tremendous pressure to call off the action, even from their closest political ally, the UK Prime Minister. Speaking in a radio interview, Gordon Brown condemned the walkout.
It's unjustified. It's deplorable. We should not have a strike. It's not in the company's interest. It's not in the workers' interests. And it's certainly not in the national interest.
And it's not in his interests. With an election looming, Brown does not want to be associated with travel chaos and cancelled holidays. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Federal Communications Commission has released a blueprint for expanding and upgrading the nation's internet capabilities. Sounds pretty good, right? As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, not everyone is happy.
Broadband speeds under the FCC plan would be at least 20 times faster than most home broadband connections now. You could download high-definition movies in minutes. If you were sick, your doctor could monitor you from home. And who would pay for all this?
We believe that on balance, the plan will more than pay for itself.
That's Bruce Gottlieb. He's the chief counsel to the FCC chairman. He says the FCC would partly fund its plan by taking some of the broadcast spectrum from TV stations and auctioning it off to internet providers. But broadcasters are scrambling to protect their turf.
Well, we're going to work with Congress to create a communication system that, here we go, got the calls coming in.
That's Dennis Wharton, the spokesman for the National Association of Broadcasters. His phone is ringing constantly with calls from frantic broadcasters. What he was trying to tell me is they're going to lobby against the FCC plan. The FCC says TV stations would be asked to give up their airwaves voluntarily and could keep some of the money after they were sold. But Wharton says the auctions wouldn't really be voluntary.
They're making it voluntary in the Godfather sense of the word. If you don't do what we're saying, we're going to force it upon you.
The FCC says it's leaving its options open, but it won't say much more than that. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The South by Southwest Conference is underway in Austin, Texas this week. The yearly gathering has become a must for people in the music, film, and technology industries. And this year, there's a new addition to the technology portion, a jobs booth. As Marketplace web producer Melissa Kaplan reports, it's a pretty popular place.
Andrea Moya is an unemployed web editor from New York. She came to South by Southwest this year to find a job.
Let's see what this is. Lynda.com, near Santa Barbara. I'm nowhere near Santa Barbara.
Moya scans help-wanted postings at the career booth in a crowded exhibition hall at the Austin Convention Center. About 200 companies have tacked up open positions. Robin Cohn is among the volunteers staffing the booth.
We've got about, you know, usually like 5 or 10 people in the booth at any given time looking for jobs. Quite a few of them have taking notes and taking down information on their telephones.
South by Southwest organizers created the career booth as a way to formalize the networking that happens organically at the conference. For tech industry recruiters, the jobs booth is a potential gold mine. Molly Auer works for the Star Group, an ad agency in Philadelphia.
Well, this is a conference that brings in the best of the best in all of technology, so I'm hoping some of those people might be interested in coming to Philly and working for the Star Group.
Web editor Moya is hoping to stay in New York and is using the jobs booth to find out what companies are looking for.
I think it's understood that everybody's here trying to make connections and meet people that will eventually get them somewhere career-wise.
And if she strikes out on a job, at least she can stick around for a good show. The music portion of the conference kicks off Wednesday. In Austin, I'm Melissa Kaplan for Marketplace.
You may have seen those colorful jackets traders wear in the trading pits of New York or Chicago. For more than three decades, one company in the Windy City has made most of those jackets, but as electronic trading gradually replaces the trading floor, that company's had to diversify, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
For the traders who work on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the trading jacket is almost like a second skin.
My black and green jacket that I've been wearing for like probably 14 years. Same one with holes in it. Gets washed, though. Don't worry about that.
That's floor trader Billy Pollivan. His black and green number is fairly standard. More outrageous get-ups include jungle print or flames, custom pockets, and pretty much all of them are made by a company called Pico on the southwest side of Chicago. But with the number of traders and clerks dwindling on trading floors around the world, Pico has had to branch out. In a brightly lit warehouse, a woman sews together two pieces of white cotton. They'll eventually form the front panel, not of a trading jacket, but a chef's coat. Pico owner Peter Papageorge says he saw the switch to computerized trading coming back in the early 1990s, so he laid the groundwork for a new business.
The whole notion was, let's do the same thing that we can do for the traders, for the culinary industry. Chef wants a purple chef coat with green cuffs and red buttons or whatever it is. We can actually make one like that, or we can make 1,000 like that.
Today, Papageorge says culinary uniforms make up 75% of the business, but traders still need something distinctive to wear on the floor. Hanging on a rack in the warehouse is part of an order for 60 new jackets.
We haven't heard from them in like 2 years, so we thought they had pretty much folded, but they must have bounced back, so...
Shirley Redmond manages the jacket division. She says in the past 8 months or so, as the markets have improved, so have orders. Peter Papageorge knows electronic trading will keep chipping away at the business his father started more than 35 years ago. But he says pundits have been predicting the demise of the trading floor for decades.
But I hope it sticks around. I hope it lasts. I really do, because that's our business, and that's a good business for us.
He's not taking any chances. The company's recently taken on a new sideline, making figure skating outfits. In Chicago, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And finally, there's a naming battle going on in Northern California. The LA Times says the U.S. Board on Geographic Names will decide whether to change a local landmark from Mount Diablo to Mount Reagan. A Bay Area man finds Diablo, Spanish for devil, to be offensive. Others say they're offended someone would want the mountain named after Reagan. The board has had its hands full in other naming requests. One suggestion had a Utah rock formation be named the Golden Arches after McDonald's. The town of Trailsview, Kansas, changed its name for economic reasons. It had been Spasticville. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.